In 3, 2, 1. Over 20 people testified on the issue of the AIDS curriculum, most of them wanting the district's emphasis to be on abstinence from sex, not on safe sex or instruction on the use of condoms. North Pole parent David Trask says the message in the district's curriculum is confusing to students.
This curriculum is full of mixed messages and needs to be changed. To say it is truly an abstinence-based curriculum and teach the proper way to have sex is a misnomer. You have a drug-free program, and a good one, that is really just that, because you don't demonstrate the proper way to sniff cocaine or shoot up IV drugs.
Rebecca Pomeroy is a junior at North Pole High School. She took the sex education class last year and wants it to continue.
Abstinence is taught in that class along with other birth control methods, and I would like to see everybody try and get teenagers to abstain from sex. It's not going to happen. You can teach it till you're blue in the face, but it's not going to happen. Kids at this age want to see what's, you know, what it's like, and so they're going to go out and do it no matter what people say. It's just like they're going to go do drugs. You need to, no, it's not safe, but you need to help lower that risk by teaching them the methods of birth control to help lower that risk.
And the board student representative, Nathan Riding, says he met with several student groups and they agree the curriculum is appropriate and meets the needs of students of today. State Health Program Specialist Cheryl Kilgore delivered a letter from State Epidemiologist John Middaugh. Middaugh called an AIDS position paper written by board member Joy Cook selective and incomplete, and said the district's curriculum is fine. But Cook claims information made public by state and national organizations is incomplete, that there are more dangers of AIDS transmission than the government has publicized. She wanted to amend the motion for curriculum review to include all other district materials pertaining to the teaching of AIDS and all the public testimony and documents presented at Tuesday night's meeting. She also wanted the reviewers to provide citations of the health and medical journals used to support or deny the curriculum, the public testimony, and submitted documents. Among the documents brought before the board was a book on AIDS information by Dr. Lorraine Day. Day claims the government only releases politically correct information. After two failed attempts to amend the motion for review, Cook abstained from the vote.
Because in my testimony, you may have noted that I admitted that our curriculum followed the guidelines prescribed by the State Health Department and the Red Cross AIDS curriculum. It follows that. Well, that is the same source that it's going to be sent to again. All right? So I didn't vote yes or no because I couldn't see any gain, you know, in a yes vote or a no vote.
Superintendent Rick Cross says he's not sure what the action will accomplish, since the state, who will review the materials, already supports the district's curriculum. He says a lot of effort will be expended to get the review done, but those who disagree with the curriculum will still be unhappy. Most board members disagreed, saying the review may update the materials being used in the classroom. Reporting for KUAC News, I'm Nellie Moore. In 3, 2, 1. O'Brien runs Golden Heart Bingo, with proceeds going to such organizations as the Fairbanks Historical Preservation Society, the Alano Club, the Downtown Association, and the Greater Fairbanks Board of Realtors. Last year, O'Brien says, for bingo, he paid out more than the 15% required by the state. But now that the amount to be paid out is 40%, he can't afford to stay in business.
And when you're running a bingo hall, it's impossible to pay that much. You have too many employees. You have your rent. You have your insurance. Of course, you have to pay your workman's comp and your other things you have to pay for employees. And it just makes it prohibitive to pay 40%.
As a matter of fact, last year O'Brien lost over $11,000 on the bingo operation. But he says, like many other operators, makes up the difference with full tab winnings.
So 15% for bingo was always taken out of the full tab share before, because there is no profit in bingo. The bingo is used to get the people in there to play the pool tabs. In a big hall, it's possible you might be able to make some revenue out of bingo, but I don't know of anybody in the state that does it.
A spokesman for the Fairbanks Historic Preservation Society says the closing of Golden Heart Bingo will delay completion of the riverboat Nenana restoration, but in subtle ways. The money raised by O'Brien was for work not included in state grants, such as extra signs or displays planned for the grand opening in July. And since the group didn't get much state money last year, bingo and pull tabs paid for paint stripping and keeping a building heated to do woodworking. The society will now be looking for ways to make up the $40,000 they got from O'Brien. Some of the organizations have said they may be looking at opening their own bingo and pull tab operations, or going for more contributions from local people and businesses. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Nellie Moore.
The probability is that we're going to have to do something. The probability is that we're going to have to do something. I'm taking this as a voter mandate now, with the sales tax ordinance. 65%, you know, and voted no again to the sales tax. And the word I'm getting from very responsible citizens in this community is that they want this council to do something. And if it does mean discontinuance of service, that's just what they want us to do. So this means we could either discontinue police service, discontinue fire service. I have no hopes at all of renegotiating any of those contracts, and I'm not even suggesting that. So that's really what I asked the city attorney tonight to do.
In 3, 2, 1. The Fairbanks City Council voted to begin the repeal process and directed city police to stop enforcement of the panhandling ordinance immediately. The council met an executive session over the issue, since they were facing a lawsuit from citizen Frank Turney over the constitutionality of the law. Turney, a local activist, filed the lawsuit after he was arrested for panhandling in downtown Fairbanks. The charges were later dropped. Turney says it's a victory for the Constitution.
The main focus on this was violating my First Amendment of free speech, and also the ordinance itself discriminated against the downtrodden, the handicapped, and the poor in our community. And I think that panhandling is just another way of reaching out.
Turney says if the law is repealed, he'll drop his lawsuit. Councilman Jerry Cleworth introduced the ordinance earlier this year to give police authority to control begging in the downtown area.
It was envisioned as a tool to help them deal with certain individuals who were vocally attacking people if they did not give money to their pen or whatever they were holding there. But obviously, the legality of that is somewhat in question right now. And so we're going to, there's really no tool or mechanism we have to address a situation that one might encounter there.
In the meantime, neither Turney nor Cleworth predict that begging will increase as a result of the repeal. Reporting for KUAC, I'm Nellie Moore. Three, two, one. By the time the Agent Orange class action lawsuit was settled out of court, it amounted to about $240 million. A part of that has gone into direct payments to veterans who can prove they were in locations where the U.S. government used the defoliant. The settlement has also been invested in a program of direct services now available here in the interior. In Fairbanks, Tima Priest is a program coordinator for what's being called the Other Forgotten Warriors Program. She says it will focus on more than the veteran.
The effects of combat trauma not only affect the vet, but affect their wives or husbands as it is in children. There's a lot of psychological effects from post-traumatic stress resulting from Vietnam, just like there's a lot of effects on the people around rape victims and victims of domestic violence and incest victims, etc.
While the settlement does not admit Agent Orange caused the medical problems veterans claim it did, families who have children with developmental disabilities can get help. Priest says that can mean a range of birth defects and anything from cerebral palsy to learning disabilities. Others who can get help are partners of Vietnam veterans who feel isolated and don't understand what the veteran's experience was in Vietnam. Some symptoms can be relationship issues, like intimacy problems and family disruption or dysfunction. A unique part of the program is that it will be reaching out of Fairbanks and into the bush using the university system of distance delivery.
There's 5 villages that we're going to target for the first year, and they will be provided with different materials. We've done an in-service with some of them on the effects of combat post-traumatic stress and the possible effects of Agent Orange on families, as well as the vet. And there'll be a audio conference course on the same subject.
Priest says she wants to establish a support group for Alaska Native veterans, and health aides can now be trained to understand the special issues involved in working with them. Women are another group Priest wants to reach. Compared to other states, Alaska has a high percentage of them who are Vietnam veterans. Reporting for KUAC News, I'm Nellie Moore. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Nellie Moore.
With ADA and the FDIC, well, with ADA, we've just completed a transaction with ADA. That's closed. FDIC, I noticed sued us the other day. That's a loan that we had with the banks. The bank went broke, the government took it over, they wanted to change the terms and conditions of the repayment of the loan. We don't feel that they should be able to do that, and that's sort of the nature of the controversy, and I guess the judge will have to decide whether the bank's going to, or the government's going to have to live up to the contract we made with the bank or not.
Is this going to have any effect on your plans here in Fairbanks?
No.
What is the status of your Fairbanks operation now?
We're conducting maintenance in the hangar. We're expanding it. We're putting about 150 people in here, and I noticed the city's is committed to extend water to the hangar now, which will be a big help to us, sewer and water out there. But we're doing all of our heavy maintenance here, and you should go out there and see it. A lot of stuff going on.
As far as the economic climate here in Fairbanks, what do you see the future for Marcia here?
Well, we, Fairbanks is always going to be a major part of our operation, both from, just flying in and out of here, but from going to be our maintenance base. And as we grow, so will our maintenance base, and as our needs grow.
Is that a permanent plan?
That's a permanent plan.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We expect to build up, I think we've committed to provide 135 permanent jobs at the hangar, but it'll be considerably more than that. I don't have a number, but as the years go by, the force will build up more and more, over 200, I'm sure. If any of you ever have a chance to go out and look at our hangar and see what we're doing out there, I think you'd be impressed. It's kind of unique.
In 3, 2, 1. When the City Council was writing the budget last month, City Councilman Mike Andrews moved $65,000 out of the police overtime account and put it into salaries, hoping to hire another policeman to help reduce the department's need to pay overtime. But now the city says it won't work. City Manager Bob Wolting says the police department won't make it through the year without the overtime money.
We'd be in a bad position if that $65,000 were left in salaries because it was taken originally from the overtime amounts, and which is, I think, even myself as well as Director Schober that doesn't leave enough overtime money to get the police department by for the year 1992.
The action taken Monday night came at the request of Andrews and Councilman Hayes. While Andrews was out of town and couldn't be reached for comment, Jim Hayes says restoring the overtime was inevitable.
Well, we pretty much knew that would happen. It was a good effort on Councilman Andrews' part to try to do that. The problem is that we just don't have the staff, and the overtime has always been a problem for us. And so all we did was what we knew we'd have to do eventually, and just put the money back in, because we have officers that are off sick. I mean, just due to the staffing level, we just can't cover it with the current budget of overtime.
The city manager says everything's being done to keep overtime under control. Last year, the council budgeted almost $200,000 in overtime for the police department. Overtime paid to police and firemen became controversial, and police salaries combined with overtime were made public during the recent municipal and sales tax elections. Some groups say the city is paying out too much for police, and the city says it can't avoid the overtime because of low staffing levels combined with requirements of the police union contract. Andrews had also shifted overtime funds in the fire department to pay for two additional positions. Wolting says he's not sure if the council will have to restore those overtime amounts in that department or not. In other budget adjustments Monday, the council unanimously voted to approve adding $100,000 to the Public Works Department to pay for contract snow removal. The money will come from a land sale to the Alaska State Housing Authority. Reporting for KUAC News, I'm Nellie Moore.
We reported profitability of about $7,600,000. That profitability is in the profit range that we've been having the last several years. This is our seventh consecutive year of profitability. We're very pleased with that. We feel that this is a very important vote, that the board of directors have voted to encourage the shareholders to vote yes on these issues. And we hope that the shareholders will turn out in record numbers to vote on this and a couple other issues. There's the youth question, the missed enrollee, the people who missed enrollment in 1971, and trying to do something special for the elders. And the purpose for that is to let those children in during that period, but in future years, leave that decision up to future boards of directors. There's several reasons for it. We really can't predict the future that well, and we want the board of directors down the road to determine whether children should be enrolled then, number one. Number two, it's an effort to slow down an issue called dilution, and so we deal effectively with them by a cutoff date in March 1992. The limitations are that it will be life estate, slightly different from the original enrollees, in that when that new shareholder passes on, the stock dies with him. It reverts back to the corporation to be issued to, hopefully down the road, additional shareholders. And one other technical requirement that is a statutory requirement. We can't change the 7I ratios among the regional corporations, so that stays the same. Other than that, there'll be shareholders of Doan Limited.
In 3, 2, 1. Thanks to the profitability of their companies on the North Slope, the 9,000 shareholders of Doan Limited have enjoyed healthy stock dividends this year. Doan President Morris Thompson says not only was this year a good one, but it's the seventh in a row.
We reported profitability of about $7,600,000. That profitability is in the profit range that we've been having the last several years. This is our seventh consecutive year of profitability.
While shareholders are getting the good news, they'll be asked to decide whether to enroll children born after the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed. Only natives born on or before December 18, 1971, were included in the settlement. But Congress amended the act in 1987. Until then, children could get stock only through gifts or inheritance. Thompson says Doyon shareholders will be asked to vote on the issue in March at their annual meeting.
We feel that this is a very important vote, that the board of directors have voted to encourage the shareholders to vote yes on these issues, and we hope that the shareholders will turn out in record numbers to vote.
Shareholders will also be asked whether to include about 30 people who were eligible in 1971 but missed the deadline, and whether to offer additional stock to elders who will be 65 years old by the end of this year. Thompson says some restrictions have been proposed for issuing stock to children. Only those born between December 19, 1971, that's the day after ANGSA was passed, and December 31st of this year, and who are at least one-quarter Native, could apply. Thompson says there are two reasons for the restrictions.
You know, we really can't predict the future that well, and we want the board of directors down the road to determine whether children should be enrolled then, number one. Number two, it's an effort to slow down an issue called dilution.
The corporation estimates that there are about 8,000 people who could be enrolled this year. That's almost doubling the number of shareholders. And Thompson says the new stock will be tailored to reduce the impact on voting and dividends, which may be issued in the future. Today's typical shareholder owns 100 shares in the regional corporation. Under Doyon's proposal, children under the age of 18 would receive 30 shares and another 70 shares when they turn 18. The stock issued this year would be life estate, which is canceled at the shareholder's death. Doyon leaders are meeting with shareholders in the villages up until March 20th, when the annual meeting will be held in Fairbanks. More than 50% of the current shareholders would have to agree to open enrollment before it could happen. Reporting for KUAC, I'm Nellie Moore. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Nellie Moore. In 3, 2, 1. In the first of a series of meetings with students, staff, and faculty of the university, President Jerome Commissar outlined what he sees as pressures on the institution.
Primarily thinking of the growing interest on the part of Alaskans to attend the university, so that we have enrollment pressures. We have pressures to work with business and industry and to provide them the kind of services that only a university can provide. And we have pressures to build our sponsored research program so that indeed we can develop an academic industry here in the state of Alaska.
But with the recent decline in oil production and prices, the state budget has taken a dive, and few state budgets have gone uncut. Speaking to a full auditorium on the Fairbanks campus Monday, Commissar says there isn't much fat left within the system, saying he sees no redundancy in programs and no savings in cutting what he doesn't see. But he says while departments may not disappear, in the future there may be less courses offered in each.
We need the subject areas, but we're going to have to contain the resources we spend in each, and that we're going to have to be very careful about the courses that we put in place to guarantee that the students have an opportunity to really get the basics of the discipline. Give them as many options as you possibly can, but it's in the option area where we may find ourselves constrained because of constraints in resources.
Concerns were raised about the morale of the staff and professors, who some say have been asked to justify their existence year after year. But Commissar thinks the exercise has been worthwhile. The talking problems through is a way of getting where the university has to go.
The faculty have put in a great deal of time and energy in reviewing what they're doing, and that is not only a strenuous issue, but it is one that detracts them from the things that they enjoy doing most, which is teaching students and doing their research. And my hope is that as we bring the analysis to good conclusions, that the faculty will begin to realize that what they did was worthwhile, and they'll also be returning to the things that they enjoy most.
In answer to concerns over the size of the university's administrative budget, Komisar says he has commissioned a team of consultants to look at the entire system, but their work has just begun and no reports are available yet. He says a series of meetings throughout the university will help him find out what people are thinking and help him represent the university better to the legislature and governor. And while there is less money in state coffers, Komisar says he remains optimistic about support for the university. Reporting for KUAC, I'm Nellie Moore. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Nellie Moore. Okay, in 3, 2, 1. Next week, the Fairbanks Board of Education will deposit $11.5 million in the borough's savings account. That's money the Department of Defense is paying for construction of Arctic Light Elementary School on Fort Wainwright. Over the past year or so, the district has been advancing money to keep the project on schedule, and construction will now begin this summer. In the meantime, the Board of Education is trying to deal with a steady rise in enrollment and not enough room in many classrooms all across the borough. And Fairbanks isn't scheduled to get any money from the state to solve this problem. Several solutions are being talked about, from double shifting to going to year-round school, but mostly the discussion has centered around the use of portable classrooms. Most school officials and teachers agree that portables are a poor solution. They're expensive, are not well suited to an Arctic environment, and make it tough logistically for elementary and high school classes that have to go back and forth to the main school. Pearl Creek Elementary is one of them, but it's located on the slope of a hill where it would be tough to put portables unless parking lot or playground space were used. But Carol Ann Webb, a parent of two Pearl Creek students, is in favor of using portables if it means more room for kids.
Granted, the logistics of it aren't great, but I'm sorry, I think I'd rather give a parking lot or a playground rather than have 30 kids in each classroom in the first grade. I mean, that is the absolute basis of their education. You talked about parent involvement. There's two parents per class, per day, in every kindergarten classroom right now helping out. I don't know how much more we can do. We're doing everything we can to reduce the student ratio, but when you get 28 screaming little kindergartners in there, it gets a little crowded with three adults and everything else.
At the same time, the district is lobbying the legislature and the governor to increase its chances of getting money for new schools. The other alternative is local bonding, and while the superintendent sees little hope of Fairbanks voting to build its own schools, Board Vice President Andy Warwick says they should pursue a bond issue if things don't go well in Juneau.
I think the chances of the state participating to the degree that we want them to is pretty low. And in that regard, I think the community is going to have to assume that responsibility. And I think, although I agree we should wait until this session is over, I think we better be prepared to assess our most urgent needs and ask the community to bond for it.
In the meantime, the district is looking at putting portable classrooms at Tanana Junior High and at Pearl Creek at a cost of about $100,000 per unit. Reporting for KUAC News, I'm Nellie Moore. Okay, in 3, 2, 1. Alaska's congressional delegation is at home this week, talking to constituents about what to do about ANWR. At a press conference Monday in Fairbanks, Senator Murkowski says the next vote on the measure will come up in the Senate Tuesday, but it will be tabled. Instead, he says, President Bush has agreed to put the measure in his economic recovery package. Murkowski says that has senators upset because development of ANWR promises thousands of jobs to a nation short of work.
Clearly, our opponents look at the economic recovery bill with ANWR in it as a very difficult issue, unlike the energy bill, because while they filibustered taking up the energy bill and proceeding to it, they don't want to do that on the economic recovery because of the focus on jobs.
The senator says Bush is committed to ANWR In a letter to Murkowski last week, the president says ANWR will provide additional domestic oil resources, add to our gross national product, and it could save billions in payments to foreign oil producers and governments. At the same time, it would provide revenue for state and federal governments. Murkowski says the administration's commitment to ANWR can also be seen in the budget proposal, which includes $3.5 billion in revenue from ANWR. The ANWR message will be delivered to Americans by the industry, which is taking out ads in what Murkowski called target locations all across the country. It sells ANWR as the provider of 735,000 jobs. Jobs for Americans, it says, in all 50 states, coast to coast.
Do you want 30,000 jobs in Ohio? Do you want 80,000 jobs in California? Well, here's a project, here's a program, and this is the major single identifier of jobs in the nation.
The ad says Alaska would get 13,000 jobs. Even Vermont would get 1,700 jobs. Murkowski says the battle over ANWR continues to be long and hard, and if Alaskans want it, they must work together. Reporting for KUAC, I'm Nellie Moore. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Nellie Moore. In 3, 2, 1. Last fall, the Fairbanks City Council wiped 25 misdemeanors off its books. Since they also appear in state law, the city enforces but doesn't prosecute those cases and has avoided paying the jail costs associated with housing the prisoners. Fairbanks Deputy City Attorney Pat Cole says the governor's action didn't come as a surprise. The city hopes to save a lot of money this year, a savings he says the state doesn't want to pay for.
And I don't really know how bad an increase it was for them, but for the city, we've probably saved between $50,000 and $100,000 a year on our change. And so we knew there would be some approach taken by the state to try and dump the cost back on us again.
The Fairbanks City Council was split on whether to take the action last fall. Mayor Wayne Nelson introduced the ordinance and was the tie-breaking vote to get it passed. Councilman Jerry Cleworth, who voted to remove the misdemeanors, says Hickel's bill is another example of a double standard. He says cities that tax themselves are once again being asked to carry the burden, while those that do not get a free ride. In any case, it's now up to the legislature to take action on the governor's proposal. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Nellie Moore. Okay, in three, two, one. The commissioner has come under fire recently for not including private lands in regulations proposed under the state's reclamation law. That's the law that requires miners to leave once mined land in stable condition. But Harold Hines says it wouldn't be fair to go ahead with across-the-board regulations because it would throw some gravel pit operators into the coastal zone management system. This, he says, would force currently unregulated pit operators to go through a complicated multi-year permitting process. In Fairbanks Friday, Hines says he's working on a solution through the coastal zone management regulations, but in the meantime, environmentalists, native corporations, and miners are objecting.
Certainly, I know there's concerns that we're not as timely implementing the regulations as some would like. On the other hand, I'm not aware of anybody not complying. Secondly, we provided an opportunity if private landowners in some way feel threatened by lawsuits by third parties or something like that, then certainly we've given them an out in terms of coming in and applying for a permit and under the public land regulation, and that ought to work. And then I guess third, to the extent that the legislature has specific concerns as to this commissioner's action in terms of implementing their law, I've I've raised the issue very openly with them and indicated my willingness to receive their guidance.
He says it's typical to find problems such as the one faced by gravel pit operators when regulations are being written to implement legislation.
It's fairly common when you go to that next step to find maybe some cases that weren't thought about in the legislative process. And that's all I've flagged to folks is that I did not want to proceed until we had cleared up this issue. Once we've cleared it up, I'm very happy to proceed.
Hines says he's not sure when he'll find a solution to the gravel pit operator problem, but it could be a matter of weeks. Reporting for KUAC, I'm Nellie Moore. In 3, 2, 1. According to Commissioner Hines, the budget situation is going to heat up in Alaska. With a negative cash flow and a shrinking amount of money pots available to be spent, he says state government will be hard-pressed to come up with the money to meet the public's demand for service. Now, he says, is the time to work on getting the gas line built.
It is going to be a major push. We're going to give this every chance it can. But what I want to make clear to you is the decision, yay or nay on this, is prescribed by both statute and regulation. It involves the Royalty Board and, more importantly, the legislature. Whatever decision is made here for the contracting of our North Slope gas would have to be approved by the legislature.
He says the state will be going out to the Midwest, the Pacific Coast, and the Pacific Rim looking for customers who would be willing to invest in Alaska's gas.
One, it's to test the market. The big question on North Slope gas has always been, does somebody really want it or not? Well, I think we've decided that it's about time we went out and let's try to ask that question ourselves. Secondly, we have the ability to go out and do that and deal with people who will be consuming that gas potentially and also interest them in investing in a transportation system for that gas. If we can do that, that will move forward the viability of the whole project tremendously.
The gas line would be one of the key factors, he says, in resolving the long-term budget needs of the Alaskan economy. The proposal is to sell half the state share of North Slope gas, estimated to be equal to about several hundred million barrels of oil. Hines says if the project were to go ahead, it would be comparable to the construction of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Reporting for KUAC, I'm Nellie Moore.
We welcome all of you to the big city of Fairbanks, and especially to the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. The dedication this year is to those individuals who have battled alcohol and drug abuse in the past, and to those who will continue the battle in the future. To show our appreciation and support, we are proudly honoring those who have made a commitment to help Native people throughout all the nations. We have...
With that, the Festival of Native Arts officially started Thursday night. The event has been a winter highlight for Fairbanks since 1973. College students from all over Alaska, as well as faculty and community volunteers, spent months working on the fine details of the event. Student coordinator Hugh Walker says FNA brings people together.
One of the most important things is bringing all different people together, and it's basically what the drum is for. It's the heartbeat of the earth and heartbeat of the people, the drums bring people together.
Native dancers from Kodiak, Barrow, Minto, Kenai, and three local dance groups will be performing. And as well, people can enjoy shopping for Native crafts from all over the state. At the festival, you can find anything from finely crafted ivory to beaded earrings to Native clothing handmade for Barbie dolls. FNA will wrap up Saturday evening with a special event.
We're planning to have an intertribal powwow. And intertribal means all tribes could dance, and all human beings at one time were tribal people, and so we invite all the tribes, whether they're Native or non-Native, to come and join in the intertribal. And the reason they called it intertribal was that a few years ago, the singing and dancing was being threatened with being lost, a lot of singing and drumming. And so the elders wanted to revive it, and they took the words out of the songs, and so now they're just chants, and that means that anybody could learn them.
Going on at the same time as Tuma Theater's productions, The Child from the Sea and Utitmun, with many Native and non-Native students performing together in rediscovery and exploration of Alaska Native performance expression. But the performance receiving the most applause by far were the JOM preschoolers from Fairbanks, 3 to 5 year olds dancing to the music of fiddler Bill Stevens. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Nellie Moore.